And beyond. And this is Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Stephen Chudy. Susan Chudy and I are out of town this week, so we're presenting a replay of one of our favorite interviews. We spoke with David Baller, who is committed to the commons, shared space, shared resources, shared lives, as a partial solution to some of the environmental, social, and technological issues of our time. Here's that interview, and I'll remind you that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views of KCFR, its staff, programmers, underwriters, and volunteers. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. I'm Stephen Chudy. Tonight we'll be exploring the ecosystem of the commons with David Baller. He's the author with Silfra Helfrich of a book called Free, Fair, and Alive, The Insurgent Power of the Commons.
I'm Susan Chudy, and David is an activist, scholar, and blogger who has focused on the commons as a new old paradigm for reimagining economics, politics, and culture. He pursues his commons scholarship and activism as director of the Reinventing the Commons program at the Schumacher Center for a New Economics and as co-founder of the Commons Strategies Group.
We'll say in advance and at the close of the program that this book for us was a paradigm shifter. We won't think and we won't talk the same after reading it. Welcome, David Baller.
It's great to be with you.
For listeners not familiar with the concept, we always do this. Every show we get tongue-tied three or four times. So
no, we don't.
It's coming, David.
What is the commons?
What is the commons?
Well, it's something that has been around, I think, from time immemorial, and it's been sort of a natural way for human beings to self-organize themselves and manage things that matter to them, or so they can develop them in a fair way and distribute them in a fair way. And it really precedes the rise of capitalist markets and the nation state. But they remain very much alive today, even though most of the focus is on markets and states as the only serious ways of getting things done. And much of my life is focused on calling attention to these very fair-minded, inclusive, participatory ways of meeting our needs without necessarily having the market or state being involved.
We had read for a long time about the so-called tragedy of the commons, and I hadn't actually looked at the original reference and thought it was about the loss of commons, but economist William Forster Lloyd, who created it in 1833, was actually talking about restricting the commons. His big concern was that open grazing was devastating the commons. So I stand... Go ahead.
He was part of, you might say, the early capitalist economists who were eager to basically divide up the commons into private property and do away with the collective management of shared wealth, whether it was forest or pastures or irrigation water or wild game. And he was the person who was, you might say, imitated by a biologist, Garrett Hardin, in the late 1960s, who wrote a famous essay called The Tragedy of the Commons. And the basic parable is that no individual farmer or rancher would have the rational incentive to hold back his cattle and not graze as much as possible, and this would result in the overexploitation of the so-called commons and its ruination. But neither Forster or Garrett Hardin were really talking about commons. They were talking about a free-for-all system where everybody took all they could without regard for their neighbors, whereas a commons is a community-driven system in which people communicate with each other, they develop trust, they develop their own rules for managing it, they even punish people who violate those rules. And so, really, the tragedy of the commons narrative is kind of a misnomer, if not a smear, on the very idea of collective management of things, because it's entirely feasible, as we see around the world, for people to successfully co- collectively manage their shared wealth.
You have multiple examples in your book. I wondered if you could give us a couple of those, that those or others that you've encountered since you wrote the book.
Well, a lot of people associate the commons with medieval England, which in fact is an important part of the heritage of the commons, but it's more prominent in Western civilization. But in fact, there are all sorts of contemporary commons, many of which are natural resource-based, like forests and farmland and fisheries and wild game and so forth, but others of which are entirely contemporary, like the Internet and digital commons. The whole open-source software is a type of commoning, the verb, where people, software coders, get together and collectively develop systems like Linux, or there's actually hundreds of different open-source software programs, which are freely shareable, reusable, improvable, and they're not proprietary and private. So that's one very contemporary, even hip example. But there are urban commons. There are socially based commons like blood banks, or there's community land trusts and community-supported agriculture and farming. There's cooperatives, and there's even digital forms of cooperatives known as platform cooperatives, where you have a digital platform, but you're, as users or consumers, sharing in both the production and the benefits. So there are, I could go on, but those are some large categories of commons, but they all share the social dynamics of people coming together to take their shared wealth out of the marketplace, manage it for their collective benefit, and share in the benefits that they collectively take responsibility for.
I'm assuming here that not every one of those examples that you've given necessarily was formulated according to the principles of commoning, but common sense has dictated that these are good directions to go.
Well, there is not, a single master theory of the commons. It all is, as you say, it's bottom-up social organization where people figure it out and they communicate and negotiate and find out what needs to be done. They draw on tradition and experience. So it's a very practically oriented way of getting things done, as opposed to some master intellectual or philosopher or leader saying this is the way to do it. And as a result, commons bear the imprint of their specific context, their geography, their history, their traditions, the culture, and so forth, which is why you have a case of a lot of similarities among commons, but all of them being quite distinctive because they have their local imprint and context as part of their identity.
So would you say, I'm off script already. Would you say that that capitalism is kind of, I'm being really extreme right now, but capitalism is greed-oriented, individualistic, me first, and at the other extreme or the other end, I'm not going to call it an extreme of this, is groups of people who believe in shared and mutually helpful systems as opposed to the individualistic notions of capitalism.
I think that, crudely put, that's absolutely accurate. It's not as if the commons really changes what human beings are, but it does get, because there's still greedy, competitive people in the commons.
Oh, okay.
But I think the difference is that you have a social system and peer group that keeps a lot of those antisocial behaviors in check,
okay.
whereas capitalism celebrates them. You know, the famous Wall Street movie with, I'm blanking on his name, but, you know, the greed is good statement,
mm-hmm, which mm-hmm.
is celebrated as the engine of capitalism. So capitalism, I think, really promotes and expands a lot of these antisocial individualistic tendencies, whereas the commons creates both a social system as well as often legal systems or institutional structures to keep those in check by, you know, the group calling someone out if they're taking more than their fair share, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. if they're violating the usage rules, which could lead to this, to the overuse of the forest, for example. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the difference comes in, that capitalism only has the regulatory state, which we've seen is often corrupted or not very capable or very centralized and not able to deal with local complexity. Whereas commons, because they're rooted at in a local scale and of an appropriate smaller scale, are more able to, let's just say, prevent and curb the anti-ecological and anti-social behaviors of people.
In the introduction of the book, you say that the book is dedicated to overcoming an epidemic of fear with a surge of reality-based hope. What is the fear that people are experiencing?
Well, I think that in contemporary times, there's just a lot of fear driven by the people not having their needs met and having precarious livelihoods that having a global capitalist system helps create, in which all sorts of absentee investors and financial markets can determine if your locality is going to be wiped out because they don't consider it worthwhile in their business model anymore. And so I think we have a lot of top-heavy global systems that are driven by capital and investors, as opposed to something that are more self-sufficient, localized, and resilient, mm-hmm. in which people's identities, not just in needing a livelihood and money, but their social relationships, their community, their local rootedness, their intergenerational ties can all be honored. And I think that's sort of what the commons is about trying to recover. And a lot of the fear, I think, is driven by the way we've organized the economy. And the commons is trying to try to reimagine the economy.
Right.
I wanted to throw in something I heard this afternoon. I was thinking about our interview, listening to Money Matters on NPR, a program that I don't much care for. Learned that in 2022, there will be something like 2 million weddings taking place at an average cost of $24,000 per wedding, which in is absurd to begin with. But capitalism has filled the gap, and there are now wedding providers who specialize in mini weddings, and they will set these up. They will, sounds sort of like the commons, they will share reception facilities so two or more couples can get together and get married. And they're smaller scale, so as they said, you don't have to invite your despised uncle to these affairs. So capitalism just leaped right in there to fill a gap, to meet a need, but all for something which I think commons theory would say we may not need in the first place, the whole concept.
Well, I think to the extent that capitalism can become the default social norms, it then, of course, has a keen interest in making that as lucrative as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The weddings you cite are an example. But I think of something like the early website called Couchsurfing, which was this international mm-hmm. gift economy of travel hospitality,
yes.
where you could be traveling to Helsinki and somebody would put you up for the night, and it would become a social occasion where they would show you around the town, they would open their home to you for free, and you would get to know each other interculturally. Well, at a certain point, that the Couchsurfing website grew to such a scale that the venture capitalists and others started to say, we could make some money flipping this and turning it into a business. And in fact, that's what happened.
Yeah.
And so now Couchsurfing is basically a travel service, not so different from Airbnb or some of these other services. And it's changed the entire character, social character and qualitative character of what it was. So I just cite that as a little anecdote for how certain things that we can do ourselves through horizontal cooperation and sharing at much less cost and arguably in a more humane, satisfying way is often commandeered, hijacked, taken over by capitalist markets, which presumably can do it more efficiently, but in the process they both privatize a lot of the shared wealth and they change the character in a way that makes it more transactional. We're just a consumer.
Right.
We're not opening ourselves to people. So, you know, that's part of the that's a process that is in the commons world we call enclosures of the commons, mm-hmm. where shared wealth is privatized, turned into a commodity, and what used to be a more open sharing relationship is essentially marketized.
So evidently, I mean, a lot of what you said so far is that commons arise when people see a need or they have a desire to do something. But you're in the work that you're doing wants to make this happen. Is there, how do you move from something that happens naturally through an identification of a shared need to something that you can encourage to happen or organize to happen?
Well, that's a, it's a great question. I think part of the answer is this is happening everywhere right now. It's just not necessarily culturally visible because we have the orientation of the press and our cultural predisposition that we don't see a lot of these things that are happening, which are really quite instinctive. But I think that commoning is happening everywhere. It's just not, we haven't connected the dots and said, oh yeah, open source seeds that aren't owned by Monsanto, that are protected from being proprietary, are very similar to open source software that's protected from Microsoft and the big tech companies. And, you know, that's one sort of dotted line you could draw, but the open source sensibility is in which you have bottom-up participation, creating your own management rules. You see that in cooperatives. You see that, you know, in something called peer production, where in online spaces, people like makerspaces or fab labs come together to do stuff together. So what part of my work is to try to draw the connections and make more visible these things. But having said that, it's also true that commons have trouble progressing too far without the infrastructure or finance. I mentioned the couch surfing. Part of the problem is they didn't have the kind of finance that capitalists have, mm-hmm. you know, out their back door. And so at a certain point, couch surfing did have financial needs that I think it was difficult for them to meet. And I think you see this with a lot of commons, like, you know, community-supported agriculture or community land trust can greatly reduce the cost of food and of affordable housing, but they're often underserviced. We don't have banks down the street that will service them.
Right.
So it often has to be kind of a crowdfunding effort or some heroic effort by a core group of people to make it happen. So another part of my work is trying to develop these infrastructures, legal systems that can support it, financial systems that can support it. And I might just add that in Europe, a lot of these things are going on at a far more developed pace than we see in the United States, mm-hmm. if only because they have, I think, more of a tradition of collective endeavors with state support.
We want to shift gears a little bit. We're both former college English professors, and we're interested in your chapter on language. Just last week, we interviewed one of your fellow New Society authors, Jeremy Lent, who's written a book called The Web of Meaning.
Yes.
And I found your chapter on language interestingly parallel to Jeremy, talking about the fact that language, once we get into language patterns, they shape our worldview. And in some ways, to get out of those patterns, we have to change the way we talk. I wonder if you could address how you describe that in your book.
Yeah, well, when my co-author Silke Helfrich and I were doing research on this book, a lot of the literature talking about the commons talked about resources. And she and I had seen, you know, dozens of commons firsthand. And we sort of balked a little bit at this word resource because mm-hmm. it implies something that is different from you, not related to you, that perhaps you might even sell as a commodity, or that a price might define its value. But in the commons, that's not the case at all. And so we had this realization that, you know, the word resource is not quite right. And a substitute word we came up with that was more accurate was the word care wealth, because you have wealth that you care about that's part of your identity and your experience and maybe your community tradition. And that's not a resource. That's something you're committed to, that you're a steward of, not just exchanging in a market. And we encountered a lot of these kinds of examples, and we started to realize that there's this whole web of language of a market culture, a capitalist culture, that encourage us to see things in certain ways, and is literally invisible, or we only experience it in fleeting ways if we don't have the words or a logic to explain it otherwise. So we came up with other words, for example, talking about an individual as if an individual is totally separated from the earth, from community, from history. We said we need to talk about the nested I, because we're all entangled and related to these other larger communities. We're nested within them. Mm-hmm. And the same with economic rationality, which considers it rational to be selfish, self-serving, materialistic, and short-term thinking, not thinking about the long-term or future generations. Well, that's not rationality. So we redubbed that Ubuntu rationality, drawing upon a South African term that means essentially I am because we are. An indigenous term that helps describe, you know, I'm inscribed in this larger community. So as we went through, we realized that we needed a new language. Both we needed to shed certain words and language of the past because it pointed us in the wrong direction, and we needed to adopt some new framings, some new words that could help us quite literally see and understand and appreciate the commons. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of what we've been trying to do. And the commons, I would just add one further note on this, that we encountered a lot of what we call misleading binaries.
Yes.
Because in a lot of our world, we talk about, well, there's the public and the private. There's the individual and the collective. There's the rational and the irrational. But we found that really these things are blurred, and those are too starkly put to say that it's either public, which we associate with government, or private, which we associate with markets. Because the commons is something that is both public and, in a way, private, because it's run by the people who manage that commons. So to carve out a third category of the commons, or to blur and integrate those binaries into a new category of thought, you might say, that's really what we need to do if we're going to escape some of the problems that our old thinking has been causing.
And beyond the level of vocabulary and the binaries, you also talk about onto stories from ontological. Could you tell us what onto stories are and how we can think about how they affect us and maybe change those narratives?
Yeah, well, we were struggling with this, Silke and I, when we were doing research on our book, and we took a break. I live in Amherst, Massachusetts, and we took a break and went to the Amherst College Geological Museum, and we encountered a fascinating story of how the former president of Amherst College in the 1840s, who was a geologist, encountered some dinosaur tracks, and he was trying to figure out what they were. Well, the word dinosaur hadn't been invented. Darwin hadn't published Origin of the Species yet, so evolution wasn't known, and this fellow was still within a biblical creationist worldview. So he quite literally could not imagine the idea of deep time, of the evolution of living creatures, and so forth. And so he had a vocabulary that reflected that, and we realized that he couldn't make what we called an onto shift, an ontological shift. Ontology is the study of being, the way reality at an existential level is organized, because he could not appreciate that life was organized in a different way. And we took this as a kind of fable for ourselves, a story suggesting that people cannot see the commons because many of them are locked into the idea of technological progress and economic growth and individualism as the engine of that, as the only way to be in the world. And they quite literally cannot comprehend collective peer organized solutions as being a way to meet their needs, even though the human race has been doing that for millennia. And if anything, the market progress, economic growth, individualism paradigm really has only existed for about 200 years in human history, which is just a fraction of a second. So we wanted to try to suggest that understanding the commons and these different pathways forward require that we be a little more self-critical about some of these cultural ideas that we've grown up with and begin to open our minds to these larger possibilities.
I just want to say to our readers, I've already said I'm enthusiastic about
our
this
readers.
Book. Our
listeners.
Listeners, what did I say? Readers? Read these chapters for yourselves, listener. The chapters on language and the Anto stories. We can't really get fully at the richness of those chapters in this interview.
Are you ready to move on? Should
yes.
we talk about the section on the social life of commoning? You describe the elements that create the potentiality, maybe, or the traits of commonality or commoning. Could you talk about these elements or patterns and talk about them?
Yeah.
We're interested in several, but you go.
Well, we had encountered, you know, as I said, dozens of different commons, and we were trying to get to the bottom of what made them successful. And it really came down to a lot of social behaviors that were played out in different ways. They were not identical, but there were certain patterns. And we drew upon this methodology of a really remarkable thinker, Christopher Alexander, who wrote a book, what he called Pattern Languages. And he was trying, as an architect and urban designer, trying to figure out why certain spaces and designs in architecture and urban design persisted across history and across cultures in very similar ways. And his answer was that it served a deep need among individuals despite the different time and places. And these were patterns that emerged bottom up. In other words, there was not some genius declaring this is the way it is. It was more all of us collectively in our circumstances figuring out, you know what, we have a problem and here's a way to solve it. Well, Christopher Alexander saw all these patterns. So Silke and I applied this pattern methodology to studying the commons, and we identified a lot of social behaviors and attitudes that seem to recur. For example, commons often ritualized togetherness, as we put it, meaning they had ceremonies or celebrations or certain events that sort of asserted their solidarity as a community. They celebrated freely contributing to the community.
I want to interrupt for just a second. The ritualizing really bothered me because that could also be regarded as reinforcing older patterns of thinking, older ontologies. And there's a lot of that goes on. Ritualizing for its own sake, and that prevents people moving into new directions. Could you talk a little more about that, please?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, rituals and traditions we often cling to when we need to let them go and move on. But they're also, I think, a social, a way that we have a certain ethical and cultural stability mm-hmm. because we publicly enact these things and they're a way that we can mutually identify with each other and share each other's purposes. And so you're right. I think it's a double-edged sword in that it can cut both ways. But in terms of commoning, there has to be a way to enact your social solidarity. And ritual could be taken too formalistically, but I think we do need to have shared practices of varying degrees of what shall I say, formality, if we're going to have some social coherence. And that's really the point of it. And a lot of these other patterns we discovered are about building social trust, building a sense of belonging, building a sense of shared purpose, so that people work together as opposed to being totally isolated individuals and really not caring about each other.
Mm-hmm. I see. You talked about a couple that interested us, especially gentle reciprocity and trust-situated knowing. I wonder if you could talk about either or both of those.
Both,
says Susan.
Yeah. Well, in terms of gentle reciprocity, the idea is like with your neighbors and you invite them over to dinner, you generally don't keep track. Oh, we've invited them 7 times. They've only invited us 3 times. You know, generally you have a gentle reciprocity, and sometimes it's for dessert, and sometimes it's for dinner, and sometimes it's lunch. But the point is to have a rough equivalence, a gentle reciprocity, in which you're giving and taking with each other, but you're being flexible. And I think that has to occur in a commons as well. It's not a tit-for-tat, even-steven deal the way market relationships are, in which I give you this much, and you give me an equivalent market value. So it's a different kind of social relationship that you have in the commons. And in terms of the situated knowing, the trust allows you to trust other people's judgments, but you're able to get the collective wisdom of a lot of people from different perspectives. And moreover, that knowledge is based on experience with, for example, the way the crops grow in that location, or the way the water runs in the springtime, or the behavior of the animals, or, you know, whatever the context is, you develop a very subtle experience knowledge of it if you're a practitioner, which may or may not be reflected in the top-down scientific knowledge, which is not to be, you know, to dismiss that, but simply to say there's an important role for situated knowledge in understanding how something works right here with this community as we've experienced it over time. So again, in a commons, that's people need to draw on their intuition and experience and traditions, and that's how the whole commons keeps working over time, this type of shared knowledge that people develop collectively.
And again, I'm thinking of the double-edged sword, because we also have a lot of trust-situated knowledge among the anti-vaxxers, the Facebook folks who are saying, yes, here's our common knowledge. We don't trust what Fauci and the others are saying. And they're a powerful community. They do have a common core of beliefs.
The only difference is I'm not sure it's so situated in knowledge of vaccines.
Yes.
I mean, it is right. It is situated locally. But you're right, and I think that, which is why I don't want to celebrate that kind of knowledge over all others. It's just that in conventional politics, it's often Washington knows best, the experts know best.
Right.
And in fact, the experts often don't know best, or they don't share the same values and priorities of the local community.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's a certain, I think we see this in a lot of climate change, where people think that we need to have a sweeping, coercive, top-down solution, when in fact I think it's more about empowering the local situated change that people can live with, support, and apply their creativity to. So we need to have a sort of, a richer dialogue between what science can teach us and what we know through our experience where we live.
So I just want to do one more of these before we move on. You all have said preserving relationships, peer governance, togetherness, contributing. Is communion with nature a universal trait among?
Well, in commons, certainly, because they're not, unlike capitalist investors who want to extract as much as they can from nature, commons are about stewardship over the long term, because you're dependent upon the renewability and resilience of nature. And so you have a different relationship with nature. In fact, you might even not even call it nature, which implies it's objective and separate from yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's more something you work with as a partner. There's even a movement these days called the New Animism for treating the world as more alive, not in a superstitious sense, but Jeremy Lentz, who you spoke to last week, probably would have a lot to say about how the forest, you know, is alive. And there's a lot of discussion these days about mushrooms and how they are in these symbiotic relationships with trees. In other words, there's a lot going on in terms of living beings cooperating with each other symbiotically. And I think that that's part of the cultural challenge we humans have today, to not regard the earth as this inert resource to extract as much of as we can, but to treat it as, with respect, as a living being that we can work with and respect, and that will benefit everyone over the long term.
And then we're moving on now. What's the role of property? How do commoning thinking regard property?
Well, this is a very long and complicated topic, but private property law is often a serious problem because it presumes that you can take a plot of land or elements of water or fisheries and have absolute rights to do with it whatever you want, when in fact ecosystems are intimately, delicately, profoundly interconnected. And I think we need to start treating these gifts of nature in a what we call as relationalized property, where we have a relationship with it as opposed to this is mine and I exclude everyone else totally. And this requires, I think, some different attitudes towards how we manage land and water and all these other elements of nature. I think the indigenous people are, while I'm not suggesting that we can revert to those ways of life, I can say that their cultural attitudes towards nature is something that we can learn, can and should learn a lot from if we're going to basically save the planet. Because we need to regard the earth as something that sustains us only if we treat it as with respect as a living being. So we need to we need to make this change, and I think that commons are one way we can start to understand that through practice, not just a moral exhortation, but something that we practice with each other, the way permaculture or agroecology or a lot of other regenerative agricultural systems are trying to do. So they're trying to apply a systems thinking, and some of them even go so far as to, you know, treat these living beings of seeds and animals and microorganisms with deeper respect as living beings.
You talked at the very beginning about the how you keep people, that there are greedy people in commons, and how you keep that in, how a group working within a commons keeps that in check. So what are ways that the commons can avoid being a undisciplined free-for-all?
Well, the great scholar of the commons, Eleanor Ostrom, who died in 2012, and she won the Nobel Prize in 2009 for her study of the commons. She had a series of design principles that she called for successful commons, and one of them was having what she called graduated sanctions for people who violate the rules of the commons. So if somebody takes too much wood from the forest or takes too much water from the irrigation system, or a software coder who is introducing bad code, the community, through people who are observing each other, will say, you know, that's really not good. We have to take some steps about that. And steps will, you want, the point is to preserve the relationship that you have with people within the commons.
Mm-hmm.
But as they if they're unresponsive to light admonitions, you have to get stronger and stronger, and to the extent that you may have to exclude them or expel them from the commons because they're too destructive of the community itself. But the point is, you're not simply having a conventional criminal trial or something.
Right.
You're trying to work it out in a amicable way to get them to understand, to get them to change. And it reminds me once again of indigenous communities that somebody breaks the code of that community, they often have, they don't simply throw them in jail.
Right.
They have a way to reintegrate them into the community through various forms of restitution or reparations. And justice is about becoming reintegrated with the community. So that's the way a commons tries to function. First of all, by getting people more or less on the same page in the first place, but then if people don't follow the rules, then finding ways to work it out in a respectful, nonviolent way. You know, there's a whole tradition of nonviolent communication
right.
that can be drawn on for this as well.
So do they have these things written down, or do these various kinds of commons groups have lists of, I have a bylaws or agreed upon community values or behaviors?
Some do, but what's interesting is that so many of these rules that people have are really so complex and subtle and informal that it would be impossible to write them all down.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of an ethic or etiquette that you learn when you become a member of the community. Well, many software communities are like this, but you know, many communities that we studied in Latin America or Africa, there were these very peculiar ways of doing things, peculiar to us, but to them, very embedded and internalized. So no, there are not standard rules, and maybe it's the Western conceit that we can just make it formal, but in fact, a lot of this is very internalized mm-hmm. and cultural and subtle. So one of the purposes of Silke and I as Westerners and Westerners from the global north was try to bring this to more awareness and make it more explicit without presuming that it's a blueprint that will suit everyone, but to try to give a framework for understanding how commons work as a social system.
It seems that would be a very intricate set of relationships then. Is there an optimal size for a commons? Can you have a great big one? And is there a commons that's too small?
Well, too small. I mean, some people have studied households as commons.
Yep.
But I think that you really can only scale to the extent that trust can still be maintained. Because once beyond that, you have to have institutional systems that people may or may not feel they really belong. On the other hand, you have things like Wikipedia that function more or less okay. They have their bumps and grinds and problems, but they have tens of thousands of members internationally, albeit in dozens of different languages. So, you know, I don't want to say there's any hard and fast rules, but you do have to have the social coherence and trust. And that often implies an appropriate scale.
And so what do you see as an appropriate scale? How many people?
Well, I think it would depend upon the type of shared wealth you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we in anthropology, they often talk about the so-called Dunbar number, which is roughly 150 people, which is thought to be the number of people that you can know by reputation and keep track of, and even, you know, ensure that they are trustworthy or not. And so I think most commons are, you know, on that order of 150 or 200 or less. But as I say, in a lot of digital contexts, they're able to scale them bigger because there are certain ways to make, at least ostensibly, to build trust within a community. But, you know, I don't think there's any hard and fast rule. It really, there's a lot of experimentation, and there's many that are quite sprawling, that because they have such intense trust, they're able to scale more.
I was interested in the word scale. It occurred to me after we sent you some questions that I think scale might be on your list of vocabulary words we should challenge, on the grounds that scale also implies a Home Depot in every neighborhood. But
yeah, scale implies centralized and hierarchical, and one system serves everybody, when in fact we like to see that commons can spread not by scaling, but what we call as emulate and federate, meaning others can do likewise at the appropriate scale, and then you can federate and have loose relationships with others, the way, for example, CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Farms, you know, there's not a competition for them to become the Home Depot of CSAs, but you can federate and be in communication and be mutually supportive. And I think we see that in a lot of transnational digital communities, from open source to wikis to open access publishing to a lot of open science. And there's a lot of different those communities that they work in their own discipline or localized ways, but they are in correspondence and communication and cooperation with others as well.
David Bollier, we just have a couple minutes left. Tell us a little bit about the Schumacher Center and your work, which I see, having looked at the website, does in fact involve spreading the word, encouraging people to set up commons across the globe.
Yes, well, I've been the director of the Reinventing the Commons program there for several years, and much of their work is about localism in terms of agriculture and community land trusts. They have an alternative currency called the Berkshires, which is a play on the Berkshires, which is the region there, which is intended to keep the value generated in that community within the community, rather than the money flowing out to the, you know, the big financial banks or big cities. So they're, in an applied sense, trying to develop a robust localism, and of course the Commons is part of that mission. In some of the ways I've been describing. So much of my work is about trying to develop these ideas and have public education about them. In the fall, I'll be releasing a new publication called The Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking, inspired by the Whole Earth Catalog.
That's great.
Format and system to try to offer little nuggets of and the variety of commons out there, just for the layperson to say, oh, there's actually a theater commons. Oh, there's a commons of programmers doing humanitarian street maps for disasters, and so on. So that's one of the projects I'm involved in. But many of my works and most of these books can be are available online for free, or of course through the publisher. But Free, Fair, and Alive, you can go to the website freefairandalive.org, and the book is up there, but of course it's also available through the publisher.
We want to thank you, David, for being with us on Ecotopia this evening. As I mentioned at the outset, there are not that many books that we regard as blockbusters or paradigm busters, and Free, Fair, and Alive is one of them. We really strongly urge our listeners to get a hold of it. We'll put up several of the website links on our website. The book itself is published by one of our favorite publishers, New Society. Go read the book, listeners. And thank you, David Bollier, for being with us this evening on Ecotopia.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen and Susan, for having me on the show. I've enjoyed talking with you.
I've enjoyed it, too. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
That was our interview with David Bollier, which, as we said, was an eye-opener and a paradigm shifter for us. Toward the close, David mentioned a Commoner's Catalog for Change-Making, which, he said, was forthcoming. Well, it has forthcome, and in the few minutes we have remaining tonight, I'd like to read from the book. It's available free or online for purchase at commonerscatalog.org. The opening section is called Life Itself is a Common. Scientific rationalism and economic thinking, two dominant forces of our time, have trouble understanding life itself. They are so intent on objectifying life to predict, control, and monetize it, forests as timber, plants as commodity crops, that they lose sight of life as a dense, complex web of subjective, adaptive agents. As eco-philosopher Andreas Weber has put it, science and economics are, quote, unwilling to acknowledge creative aliveness as an ontological foundation of reality. This is not surprising, continues David Baller. Since the Enlightenment, Western civilization has drawn a bright line of separation between humanity and nature and between mind and nature. More recently, we moderns have dubbed our period of geological time the Anthropocene era, as if to reaffirm our commitment to emancipating ourselves by dominating earthly systems. The idea persists that the universe is essentially a clockwork and living systems are animate machines, as Enlightenment thought presumes. In recent years, however, evolutionary and social sciences have begun to see the world with a new perspective. Scientists are recognizing that the famous survival of the fittest narrative, with its focus on individuals and competition, ignores many subtle long-term cooperative relationships that shape and sustain living organisms. Focusing on individuals in isolation provides a grossly limited view because all living creatures are nested within larger systems. Life arises and flourishes only because living beings co-create each other, slowly weaving a complex web of interdependencies. Life itself is revealed as a commons. This commo vision of life as relationships is gaining greater currency. What does evolutionary science reveal about cooperation? In the 1970s, chemist James Lovelock and microbiologist Lynn Margulis co-developed the idea that living organisms and the Earth interact with each other to create the larger, stable, self-regulating biophysical system that sustains life in many forms. Their Gaia hypothesis, named after a Greek goddess who personified the Earth, was dismissed out of hand for years, but it is now widely accepted. The willingness of scientists to focus on relationality among living systems and to think holistically about how systems work has opened up new ways of understanding the world. In 1972, Chilean biologists Humberto Maternana and Francisco Varela described how organisms self-organize and maintain themselves as quasi-autonomous beings through a process they call autopoiesis. Their work showed how symbiotic cooperation among organisms occurs even at the cellular level, often in subtle and non-obvious ways. The rise of complexity sciences, too, has shown that life arises through entangled relationships of interdependence. Shift your perspective from the individual to the whole, and it's easier to see that cooperation is a key way that organisms improve their evolutionary fitness. Within evolutionary sciences, it was long believed that natural selection revolves around individuals, not groups, as seen in the competitive struggles of individuals for survival. Many prominent biologists in the 1960s argued this case because they didn't believe that enough individuals are willing to sacrifice their self-interest to benefit a group, the idea of altruism. But in the 1990s, a number of evolutionary scientists such as E.O. Wilson, David Sloan Wilson, and Martin Nowak, and complexity theorists like Samuel Bowles argued persuasively that group selection or multi-level selection are powerful forces in evolution. They made the case that natural selection favors cooperation at a group level. Wilson and Sloan Wilson summarized their reasoning this way, quote, selfishness beats altruism within groups. Altruistic groups beat selfish groups. Everything else is a commentary. In other words, groups of cooperators will outcompete groups of selfish individuals. Other researchers, such as Michael Tomasiello, have conducted experiments with infants and toddlers to assess their propensity to cooperate before their acculturation into the adult world. After confirming that infants from 14 to 18 months of age have the capacity to fetch out-of-reach objects, remove obstacles facing others, and correct an adult's mistake, among other experiments, they concluded that human beings have inborn instincts to help others. What makes human beings different from primates, he said, is our ability to put our heads together and do things that none of us could do alone, to create resources that we couldn't create alone. Science is looking into the whole question of whether or not humans are naturally barbaric. Is savage cruelty the default setting for human nature? This is one lesson that millions of high school students learn when they're assigned to read Lord of the Flies by William Golding. This classic novel is the story of a band of British schoolboys shipwrecked on a desert island. Forced to create their own society, they end up shedding the veneer of British civilization and revealing themselves to be utterly brutal and depraved. When the constraints of civilization and state power disappear, the story tells us, we revert to savagery. We supposedly choose barbarism. Since its publication, Lord of the Flies has been translated into more than 30 languages and sold tens of millions of copies. People apparently wish to believe that humanity is disturbingly sinister at heart, or at least that that narrative is darkly thrilling. But is it an accurate depiction of human nature? When researching his 2019 book on human cooperation, Humankind, A Hopeful History, Dutch historian Rutger Bergman discovered that The Lord of Flies was merely a figment of Golding's perfervid imagination. It was not an empirical account of humanity. By accident, Bergman discovered an actual incident of shipwrecked boys on the South Pacific. This happened in 1965. Australian boys, ranging in age from 13 to 16, were caught in a storm, shipwrecked on the abandoned island of Ata for 13 months. The teenagers did not descend into barbarism as in Lord of the Flies. In fact, they made a pact never to quarrel. The captain who rescued them found that the boys had set up small communes with a food garden, hollowed out tree trunks to store rainwater, a gymnasium with curious weights, a badminton court, chicken pens, and a permanent fire, all from handiwork, an old knife blade, and much determination. The boys survived on fish, coconuts, and tame birds, seabird eggs, wild taro, bananas, and wild chicana. In Lord of the Flies, the boys got into fights about who would maintain a fire to alert would-be rescuers. But the boys on Ata assiduously kept their fire going for more than a year. They had a roster for tasks, which they did in pairs. If arguments erupted, they agreed to a timeout. Bregman writes that their days began and ended with a song and a prayer. Bregman notes that Golding, as a person, was apparently unhappy, alcoholic, and prone to depression. Golding even acknowledged Nazi-like tendencies in himself, writes Bregman. Golding may have wanted to channel the spirit of Thomas Hobbes, the political philosopher who argued that a state is needed to keep order and enforce social concerns because we individually can't contain our own savagery. A Hobbesian story like The Lord of the Flies certainly helps justify our supposed need for the modern coercive state. It also rejects the idea that we are capable of organizing a stable, humane social order. Fortunately, Bregman's discovery of the stranded Australian boys helps validate a very different story about humanity. That's all I have time for. I've been reading from The Commoner's Catalog for Changemaking by our guest, David Baller. It's available online and for purchase at www.commonerscatalog.org. Stay tuned for North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon. Thank you for listening to Ecotopia. This is KZFR 90.1 Chico, California. Community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
Get your groove on Saturday, August 20th at the Patrick Ranch Museum for Chico Summerfest. In addition to a kids' zone, beer garden, food trucks, Boston and Pat Benatar cover bands, this year's Chico Summerfest includes a KZFR station.